Hey everyone, Mr. Warren Hayes here on a Thursday. So you know what that means. It means it's time for the AEW Dynamite review right here on youtube.com/Mr. Warren Hayes or on your favorite podcast audio. Look, and you know, per usual, like the video if you're watching this on YouTube. Consider subscribing as well. Subscriptions, likes, helps the podcast grow, helps gets my stuff out there more. I appreciate any kind of support on that level. Plus, it's the same thing on the audio, right? 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, 5-star rating on Spotify. You all know the drill by now. But, you know, sometimes it's like, hey, don't forget, you know, good intentions and whatnot. It's just that simple. Maybe I will reach the day, one day, where I no longer ask for that, but maybe not also. Who knows? But yeah, no, listen, as we usually do here, AEW Dynamite, today is February 2nd. It is Groundhog Day. I think we're getting 6 more weeks of winter. But, you know, if it also means that we get 6 more weeks of great Dynamites like we got last night and like we've been getting over the past month and a half, maybe with last week being a slight exception, I'm okay with it. Do we have a Groundhog's Day for like, or a groundhog that judges, that predicts the quality of wrestling shows? I think we should have that. If we don't, we need to petition for that. Usually, you know, I like to start things off talking about some of the meta going around AEW. Now, I know this morning there was a Bloomberg long-form article, an interview that was more like, not necessarily an interview, like it touches on a bunch of things regarding Tony Khan, AEW, and the wrestling business in general, because the article talks about Vince McMahon and his shenanigans right now on with everything that's going on with the sale, him returning, his coup. I've skimmed through the article. I haven't had time to read it really. Of course, there's the news coming out that apparently in AEW, they want to set up their own streaming service with Warner Bros. Discover Bros. So, look, there's lots of little news bits and items like that, but I want to take the time to read the article correctly. And I feel like this is proper content for the Mr. Warren Hayes show on Tuesday. So if you want to, look, subscribe and you won't miss my thoughts on that. But for now, we're going to set that aside. But there is a couple of meta items that aren't necessarily related to the show specifically, but are still related to AEW that we can touch on here today. Such as yesterday, AEW had announced the launch of live events, house shows, if you prefer, calling AEW House Rules, continuing the gambling theme. Let me read the first paragraph here of the press release. AEW CEO, GM, and head of creative, Tony Khan, announced today the launch of AEW House Rules, a live event series taking place on select weekends in markets across the country. Continuing the promotion's meteoric rise and following the success of AEW Dynamite on Wednesdays on TBS and AEW Rampage on Fridays on TNT, fans can expect an up-close and personal experience at local venues, along with a spectacular and engaging environment. These non-televised live events will showcase an electrifying mix of matchups featuring the stars of AEW. Each event offers an even more immersive experience for fans, including customized merchandise, unique ways to engage with featured talent, and in-show interactions different from what is featured on televised AEW programming. We'll stop right there. Very interesting. Look, I've talked about this a few times, and I've even tweeted about it, especially when it started to rumble right at the start of the year. At the start of 2023, there were rumblings that AEW would be looking into getting some house shows off the ground. Hell, that's why Jeff Jarrett was brought aboard. And everyone was like, oh, it's a bad idea. And I said, if AEW can afford to do it, because that's always the thing, they absolutely should. There is nothing but upside for AEW to do this. Little extra revenue, but most importantly, like for the talent, you cannot stress enough. You cannot stress enough how crucial it is for a lot of the on-television talent to be able to work in environments where the cameras aren't on them so they can try stuff out. So they can, keep perfecting their craft. There's nothing like working in front of a live crowd to get this done. I've had tons of people respond to me and say, Warren, they could just go out there and work the indie circuit. It's not the same if you're working for your employer. If you're working for, and if you're working with people in your locker room, because then what does that do at the same time? Then you work with other people in the locker room, your squad mates, right? Your fellow employees, people that you might have to interact with on television. So I think that it's not necessarily comparable. I get the idea of saying, send them out on the indies, let them get some reps. But if you're not going to send them out on the indies, because look, hey, let's not forget, if you go to an indie show, you have to clear it with the boss. It becomes a headache. Then there's booking considerations. And, there's a lot of politicking that happens and a lot of, things that, this is the contract and so on and so forth. And these are the fees, And maybe there's some AEW talent who want to get out there and do the indies. But the indies don't want to pay the fee for that person. Look, there's a whole bunch of there's certain people that probably for the fee that they're requesting, they might not be the draw that the local indie promotion wants, let's say. You're not always going to get a John Moxley for the fee, right? You might get someone else and you're like, wow, this is a little outrageous and I don't think they're a draw, right? And that's legitimate. That's a legitimate concern from an indie perspective, from the promotions perspective. And it's probably, if you don't have a working relationship with Tony Khan, who has shut down a lot of indie work for a lot of people, especially in GCW, maybe he's like, I want to be able to offer this so that my talent will work out the kink. So they can try stuff out on TV. Hell, Tony can even try out some angles if he wants. There's so many things that can be done in a house show environment that makes sense after to, make its way on television, get some kinks out. It makes tons of sense. Like there's nothing but upside. There's another upside for the fans that we're going to talk about in a second here. I like this. I wonder what this idea of custom merchandise they're talking about, right? Customized merchandise. That's interesting. Unique ways to engage with featured talent and in-show interactions different than what is featured on AEW. I mean, we see this regularly with, AEW live events, WWE live events, house shows. The interactions, since you're not running on primetime cable TV, the talent can be a lot looser with what they're doing, with the amount of time they interact with the fans. They can take more time to slap hands and, fool around, take selfies and all that stuff. That's a big deal. So there's that's different from the get-go. And in the ring as well, The guys, the gals, they're looser. They're having a good time. It's more like this is how you build chemistry within your roster. You just have them do stuff, have a good time, and just like wrestle for the sake of wrestling as opposed to, being in this super high pressure environment. And I think that's beneficial. I think it's beneficial for the talent. It's beneficial for the fans. There's frankly, again, like I said, if AEW can afford to do it, there is no reason for them to not do it. And what was one of the things that I had said? If you recall when I was arguing this, what was one of the things that I said? Lower ticket price point for fans to come see this. They're going to go into smaller markets. They're not hitting up LA and, you know, Manhattan and, you know, so on. Miami, Chicago. They're going to go into smaller markets. They're going to, it'll be a minimal setup. It's not going to be the full Dynamite setup. That means they can lower the prices. Because probably for a lot of wrestling fans, the price point for tickets is maybe a little high. And that is also the point of a house show, is like price tickets are lower. Well, look at this paragraph here. In the first AEW House Rules show will take place on Saturday, March 18th in Troy, Ohio, at the Hobart Arena, and will feature Ohio's own Jon Moxley, Claudio Castagnoli, Dr. Britt Baker, Darby Allin, Orange Cassidy, and many more. So right off the gate, they're like, yeah, we're stacking this with people that we know you really like. Moxley, Britt, Darby, Cassidy, arguably some of the most over acts in the company. Claudio's great. So, you know, he's going to be there. He gets great reactions and, you know, you're going to get a good wrestling match out of there for sure. Tickets for AEW House Show Rules start at $20 plus fees and can be purchased at AEW Tix starting Friday, February 3rd. So tomorrow is the time I'm recording this. $20. $20 will get you in. I think that's fantastic. And that's what it's for. This is what it should be for. It should be something that you can, like, on a Saturday evening, you're like, well, let's take the kids. A little family outing. We'll go to an AEW show. $20 is what it costs, like, for one person to go to the movies these days with popcorn and whatnot. I think this is a very reasonable way to approach things. This makes tons of sense, and there is going to be benefits. Again, like I said, can AEW afford to do this? Well, I personally don't know. You can only assume that they can, since they're doing it. And the live event spectrum that existed previous to this, previous to 2023, has changed dramatically. Because previously all we had to go on was WWE, correct? WWE was the only game in town. So they were the only show that we could base ourselves on. And for years, from 2019 up until the end of the pandemic, house show events, live events, have been in the toilet for them. They had been a losing commodity. And even previous to that, years before that, even if live events operating income for WWE had been on the rise, the live events, the house shows, had been losing money. They've been money losers for WWE for years. Now we're out of the pandemic. Everyone seems to want to go to a live show. When I say out of the pandemic, you know what I mean. Look, you know, the pandemic's not over. But you know, I know you're smart enough to interpret what I mean here. Now that most of the restrictions have been lifted, or all restrictions have been lifted in North America anyway, and people are hitting the live shows, you know, they want to get out of the house. They've been trapped, cooped indoors for 2 years. You know, last year that was clearly a boon for WWE. That was clearly a boon. And it's continuing so far. Like, even into 2023, you know, people are rushing to see the live shows because they haven't seen the live show in so long. So, you know, the live event industry right now is happy. But holy smokes. It was really bad before. It was bad before the pandemic. Now it's going well. Why wouldn't AEW want to try and ride that wave? It all makes sense to me. I think it's a good environment to do it. And, you know, they're running the Hobart Arena in Troy, Ohio, city I had never heard of. Don't blame me, I'm Canadian. It's a concert. As a concert venue, it can hold up to 5,200 people, just shy of 5,300 people. When used for hockey, the Hobart Arena has a sellout capacity of 4,500. So again, this is a smaller venue. I don't know what the setup is going to look like for wrestling. But again, this is a smaller venue. And again, this is what I said. They're not going to go out running basketball arenas here. So this is very interesting. This is very, very interesting. And I think that the more they run these shows, the more it goes on, I think we will see eventually benefits being paid off on television for the viewing audience, for the home viewers. I think it will pay off tremendously. Might take a while, but. And the other item of note within the AEW meta over the past couple of days came when Kota Ibushi was announced to be doing the GCW collective shows during WrestleMania weekend, or at least he's announced for Bloodsport, and he's announced for Janela's Spring Break. So he's going to be working those matches during WrestleMania week. And that was announced, I believe, on the 31st. Shortly thereafter, we got an official announcement from New Japan saying that his contract has effectively run out and that it was not renewed. So Kota Ibushi is back to being a freelancer, which is exactly how we know Kota Ibushi. This, you know, Kota Ibushi being out there doing whatever the hell he wants is much less surprising than Kota Ibushi agreeing to sign a contract with New Japan. I think that one took most people by surprise because he's such a free spirit. He's such a guy who does whatever the hell he wants. That when we turn around and we see him signing a contract and locking himself down, something that he has refused to do for such a long time, I think everyone was a little shocked. Now, I think it's safe to say that Kota Ibushi doesn't work well in a contracted environment. I think it's safe to say. But why am I talking about this on the AEW, on AEW programming, right? Well, because of course there's a lot of the speculation immediately started, and I myself, I'm like, what could be the thing here? The speculation has already started wondering as to whether or not Kota Ibushi might work AEW, and there's already been comments out there. There's already been reports like of the Young Bucks saying, yeah, we'd love an opportunity to work with them if it works out, and so on and so forth. Ibushi has very, very deep rooted history with Kenny Omega, of course, the Young Bucks, they're all friends. So there's, you know, there's part of this that makes sense. So, you know, it's an easy 1+1 situation where AEW fans are now rubbing their hands together and getting excited. I think it's entirely plausible. You know, and you know, Ibushi's been asked and he's been out there and he says, look, yes, you know, I want to do other things, but of course, you know, but I want to do other things, but I'm going to talk to AEW and eventually, you know, we'll chat and we'll see what happens. But, you know, I think it's safe money to bet Kota Ibushi showing up on a Dynamite working a pay-per-view. I think that's safe money. Because the ties are there and they're real and they're deep. And it's something that North American fans would lose their mind over, because if we're talking about a high profile, very high profile freelancers, free agents out there in the wrestling landscape, Ibushi right now is at the top. If we consider Mercedes Moné to be signed right now to New Japan, Bushiroad, whichever way you want. If you consider her to be signed right now, Ibushi is absolutely like the top free agent in wrestling right now. So he's getting offers right and left. You know the Fed has reached out to him because of course they have to. The one thing that I think that expectations need to be curbed a little bit. Again, if there's anything, I'm trying to say too many things at once, but let's start off like this. If there's one thing I feel where, if there's one area where expectations need to be curbed, is this idea of Kota Ibushi at Forbidden Door 2. First of all, he's a free agent. So it's not even a question of Forbidden Door stuff anymore. It's just like he can wrestle wherever he wants. Why not have him at Double or Nothing instead? You know, just make it a little interesting kind of thing. So that, you know, that's one thing. Because him being at Forbidden Door 2, there's no reason. He's not contracted to New Japan anymore. And, if Forbidden Door 2 continues to be an AEW New Japan co-promoted show in North America, well, New Japan doesn't want anything to do with Kota Ibushi. Ibushi was outright slandering the president of the company. So I think it is a safe bet, and everyone agreed to let the contract run out. I think it's a safe bet to say New Japan would probably, Gedo sitting around a table with Tony Khan would probably tell Tony, if that were to be brought up, he'd probably say, yeah, it's not going to work for me, brother. And I think that's fair. You know, it's been well documented that, you know, Ibushi's tirades last fall didn't quite go over well with a lot of people in Japan, including people in New Japan and some of his contemporaries, fellow wrestlers, and guys who have straight out said, I consider him to be a friend, but I can't support what he's doing right now. There's other ways to be doing it. Like, I would assume he has if we're going to use wrestling terms here, I would assume he has a substantial amount of heat with New Japan. From what we know, from what we gathered, I think it's fair to say. So this stuff about Kota Ibushi being at Forbidden Door 2, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't correlate. You haven't been following the story if you think that that's a possibility. Kota Ibushi at Double or Nothing. Kota Ibushi at All Out. Absolutely. Kota Ibushi on a fucking random Dynamite, headlining a Rampage. Absolutely. That all makes sense. But at a Forbidden Door show, at a co-promoted New Japan, I don't think so. I think our boy Kota is persona non grata in New Japan and probably will be for a while. But here is my caveat. Here's the asterisk. If there is anything that 2022 has reminded me in regards to professional wrestling, is that anything can happen. And the world of pro wrestling is weird and wild, and absolutely anything can happen. Because we all thought that Cody Rhodes leaving AEW last year would be the biggest story of the year, and Jesus. And in any other normal year, it would be. But it was double downed on so many times. Anyway, keep an eye on the Kota Ibushi stuff. At the very least, he will be in North America to wrestle for GCW in a little over a month's time. But absolutely, it is an absolutely logical thing to expect Kota Ibushi in AEW at some point. Absolutely. Forbidden Door, that's something I can't get behind. All right, let's get into the proper talk now for AEW Dynamite for the show last night. Dayton, Ohio at the Nutter Center. Yeah, everyone makes those jokes, right? This guy. Anyway, for February 1st at the Nutter Center, according to WrestleTix, this was very close to being a sellout as of yesterday. 782 tickets remained. out of a 4,838 setup for the show. Not a bad gate. And it started off. And it's awesome because people were like, how is this not your main event? Oh, brother. Oh, Nelly. Oh, boy. I'll tell you why this wasn't the main event. But it started off hot, just like a Dynamite should. John Moxley defeating Hangman Adam Page. And again, I saw people, Page should have won. There's an actual history of winning in your hometown when you're in AEW. Why would we have done anything different here? Plus, look. Mox comes out, he's joined by Wheeler Yuta and his father, John Moxley's father, which is interesting because if you've read John's autobiography, you'll know that he doesn't necessarily have the best relationship with his dad, but maybe there's some fence mending. I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool. Just so happens his father is Jigsaw from the Saw movie franchise. I don't know if y'all noticed that. And Mox lays into Paige before the bell. And there's a big brawl that occurs before the match officially starts. They fight into the audience. Mox even figure fours Paige on the floor, works the leg. He even wants to try to Pillmanize the leg, but the ref prevents him. Adam Page suplexes him on the floor onto a chair. Finally, they get into the ring and the match kicks off. Mox is already split open. He locks in a leg lock onto Adam Page. Follow away. Slam by Adam Page as well. They try to pile drive each other on the apron over and over until Hangman Page, Fireman, carries Mox and launches him into a post. Page tries to kick his fucking head in. It doesn't quite work out, but he does hit an Avalanche DVD. How about that? Avalanche Death Valley Driver. Page then kicks him to stay down, but that just fires up Mox, who hits a cutter. They both have a chop exchange, standing sleeper is reversed into a backdrop driver by Adam Page. Mox gets back up, hits a back body drop. Lands an arm trap superplex, does the hammer and anvil elbows, kicks his fucking head in, goes for the Death Rider, but it's blocked. So what does Mox do? He just transitions into a Jujigatami. Adam Page eventually dumps him onto the floor, goes for the Orihara moonsault. Mox has been watching Samoa Joe tapes. He just nopes and moves out of the way. Lands a lariat on the floor, drags Adam Page to the timekeeper's table. But Page lines a pop-up powerbomb through the table, gets back into the ring, hits a deadeye, covers, Mox kicks out. He lands a King Kong lariat. I love how commentary loses their shit now when that happens. See, that's the cool thing to come out of an unfortunate situation when it comes to wrestling. Now, moving forward, Mox's King Kong lariat just looks like a disaster. It's like a disaster waiting to happen. So when it happens, people pop out of their seats now. Huge fisherman's drive into a package, followed by Page, which was just great stuff. He goes for the buckshot lariat. It's reversed. Then we get a Death Rider attempt. That's blocked. And then Page hits a tombstone, goes for the buckshot lariat, covers, Mox kicks out. So then Page locks in the bulldog choke. But Moxley fights through it and rolls into a stack pin for the win. Just sneaks one out of Adam Page. And this is what's good here. Here's where we're at right now in this feud. Page got knocked the fuck out, right? Adam Page comes back, beats this piss out of Moxley, knocks him out. Storyline this time. Mox is gone for 2 weeks. He comes back and he sneaks in a win. So it doesn't even come off as we've done everything we could here. No. There is still, he snuck a win. And then after the match, the BCC is there, Claudio, Yuta. They're there to hold Moxley back because he still wants to go. Paige is in the ring and he wants to go. He's doing push-ups. It's like, I'm ready to, let's fucking go. I can still go. We are not done with this feud. And I think this is great. Because everything about these matches have been great. Everything that these two guys have been doing since Paige returned from his injury, everything they've been doing has been spot on perfect. Even down to the pre-match, the vignette, the road to vignette that they shot with Mox saying, you know what? I hate losing. That's what pisses me off in the world, most in the world. Let's go. And they're both leaning into it. And they both come across as tough guys. Like, this is a good wrestling feud. And here's the thing. I think they're going to run this again. And I think they're going to run this at Revolution under a stip. And probably a last man standing type of situation. Because this has been the story of their entire feud. It's like, you knock me down, I get back up. I don't want to lose. Who's the better guy? They want to beat each other till one guy can't stand up anymore. That's their thing. Paige might be a little conflicted about it. Mox has no problems with it. Mox is like, this is my job. That's your job to get beat up, Adam Page. I think they're going to run this at Revolution again. And I'm here for it. This is an excellent, excellent pro wrestling feud. I have no issues with them running it again. Because you know what that means? That means they have another one in the chamber that they can grow on. This was excellent. This was a fantastic opener. This is another great, dynamic, energetic, fired up match to start the show. This is AEW telling you, hey, you got to be on your toes here, because when we ring the bell, and even before the bell was rung, when we start our show, if you're not here for some actions, I don't know what you're doing, but you're here to, we're going to deliver. This was great. Again, great. And I don't know if anyone has talked about this or noticed this really, but one of the criticisms, and I sort of haphazardly had noted this for a couple of weeks and I didn't talk about it, but we're going to talk about it here. You know, I think a very justified criticism of AEW's production was like, you know, we would cycle in and out of segments very, very quickly. A match would end and then we'd go to something else and we'd never let like the end of a match breathe. We never had the time to let things stand and allow the audience at home and in the arena to just let the event sink in, let the guys pose, AEW has been doing a much better job at that. Instead of doing like Crash TV, we got to cram as much shit into here as possible. And we're just letting things breathe a little bit. And I feel like this was, every match tonight benefited from this. Jamie Hayter is backstage. She's being interviewed by Renee Paquette with the Bunny, who is accompanied by Butcher and Blade. Bunny wants an eliminator match on next week on Dynamite. Jamie says, sure. Then there's a screen there. And on the screen, we see footage of Saraya and Toni Storm beating the piss out of Britt Baker. So, of course, Jamie is like, oh, I'm going to go see if she's okay. We end that segment there. Let's talk about, there's another segment that happens later on in the evening. Well, let's combine it to here because there's a thread line here. Because later on in the evening, we see Brett. She's being checked out by medical personnel, being asked if everything's okay. Ruby Soho arrives and she asks, are you good? Britt says, you know, it's your girls that attack me. And I think it's kind of weird that you show up now. It's kind of strange. And Ruby says, yo, I didn't have anything to do with that. So we are indeed going towards where do Ruby's allegiances lie? Is she with the international talent? Because we can't say WWE. Or is she with the homegrown talent, which is you know, or we should call them the originals is really what we should call them. Because I, you know, it really rubs a lot of people the wrong way calling themselves homegrown. But here's the thing. If the girls want to call themselves the homegrown talent, let go. Just let them do it. I understand that Jamie Hayter has tons of experience outside of AEW, and that's why she's an instant success in this company, because she's bringing with her years upon years upon years of experience in wrestling in Japan, in Europe, everywhere. That's why she's so good at it. She's not a homegrown talent like you could say Jade Cargill is. And frankly, you know what they should do with this? They need to add Jade to this story. They need to add Jade. Jade has to stop being in her own cosmos of pro wrestling here. She needs to be added to this in some way or another. They did the 50-0 storyline. We're going to talk about it in a bit. You know, now she's 50-0. That's great. But there's got to be more for her to do than to be squashing women who the audience doesn't perceive as a legitimate threat to her. And I think if they're doing an AEW versus the quote-unquote not WWE women, don't say WWE women, right? She needs to be a part of this. And she will add a level to this that will be very interesting. She needs to start interacting more with this strata of women in the company, with the Britt Bakers, with the Toni Storms. That's what she needs to do. The Acclaimed defeat Truth Magnum and Turbo Floyd. This is a squash. Not much to say here. After the match, though, the Gun Club arrive. They start talking shit. Acclaimed talks shit back. Billy Gunn says he's got enough. And he says, I don't give a shit. Fight each other. I don't care anymore. There's a lot of shit being thrown around. And then Billy Gunn not having any shit. As he's walking up the ramp, Austin Gunn accuses him of turning his back on his sons again, like he did in the past, tells him to drown his sorrows in the bottom of a pill bottle, and that fires him up. So he returns, he being Billy Gunn, returns in a huff, and he says they're getting a tag title shot next week. I'm telling you, I'm not into this. I'm not into this at all. And, you know, I have an issue with using real life addictions in storylines and whatnot, because for multiple reasons. And I think the most important one is being that pro wrestling has such a terrible, terrible history of addiction that has led to careers and lives being destroyed. I find it arrogant to a degree that we're cool with it being run in storylines. There's always exceptions. There will always be moments where I'm like, okay, this, I can see how this works, right? But, you know, there's the implications of the amount of the decades of pill abuse, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, In pro wrestling has led to multiple wrestlers being taken from us way too early, whether just losing their lives or having their careers shortened for reasons that weren't being cared for, medically speaking. And here I think it's. As opposed to other occasions where I feel like in the context it works. Here I find it's a little cheap. I think they went for some cheap seriousness to be brought to this in an angle so far, which has been nothing but goofy. So the tonal shift here it feels weird to me. It comes off as strange. And I'm, you know, a couple of weeks ago, they were they had the guns dropping their pants on a rampage. Last week, they were doing a therapy session where, you know, where the therapist was going, you know, and now suddenly we get, oh, but you turned on your back on us when we were kids. This is a weird tonal shift. And I'm not into it. I am absolutely not into it. And I told you guys, I've been saying this for a couple of weeks. I think that ultimately this can harm the Acclaimed more than anything else. Because this isn't great. This isn't fun. And it's not playing off of their strengths. I think this ultimately could have damaging effects on the Acclaimed, because this so far has not been good. It has not been good. Maybe this angle last night was a little less sports entertainy than what's happened in the past, and which, you know, y'all know I have issues with, but here, nah. It's officially not working. Jungle Boy Jack Perry is backstage, he's being interviewed. He says he had an amazing time teaming with Hook, and he'll always have his back, and Hook will always have his back, but he's done with the tag team thing for now. What? What are you talking about? Are you kidding me? We're already pulling the plug on Jungle Hook. Listen, I believe 100% they had something. They had something special with the presentation of these two young, handsome, strapping guys, up-and-coming professional wrestlers who are very good at what they do. You know, I know Hook is still, he's still in the learning phases of his career, but this concept of, you know, if you want to use the Rock and Roll Express analogy, where Hook is Gibson and he gets the hot tags off of Ricky Morton, Jungle Jack Perry, Ricky Morton. It would have, they had something special, something great in the presentation. I feel like this might be a bit of a missed opportunity. But then at the same time, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Maybe we'll just get more excited when they do eventually reunite or start working together or whatnot. It's not a complete kibosh, because Perry did say, oh, you know, we still have each other's back. But, goddamn, man, I'm a little disappointed in this direction. But I also understand that the plan for Jungle Boy was probably not to toss him back into another tag team, because they broke up his first tag team so he could have a singles career. You're not going to go drop him back into another tag team. The fuck are we doing here? So it makes sense. I might not like it, but it makes sense. So he wants to focus on a singles career. That's what he says in the bit. Does this mean, and I'm just throwing this out there very, very gently, does this mean that Christian Cage might be mounting his comeback? Is he soon to be cleared? Because I would assume, this is what I would assume, is that Perry was put into this tag team while waiting for Christian to get back on his feet, to have something to do for Jack Perry. Now that maybe Christian is on his way back, slowly but surely, so now we're going to warm him up as a singles guy again. You know, it makes sense to me. I guess, as Alexa Bliss once told us, we'll have to let this one play out. Kanesuke Takeshita defeated Brian Cage in a fun little match, giving us, officially, Takeshita's first win in AEW on AEW Dynamite, I should say. Because he's been winning on Dark and whatnot. But a first televised win for this guy. And they had to do it. It had to happen. He's under contract now. He's not just a guest. TK has high hopes for him. Let's go right ahead. Let's do it. Let's have him start winning matches. He hits a flying lariat and a pescado early on in the match. Cage power bombs him right into the ring post. They trade some forearm shots. Then Takeshita lines a blue thunderbomb, second rope, deadlift, suplex by Brian Cage, which is always a fantastic spot. Drop toe hold by Takeshita, tiger feint kick by Cage as well, missile shotgun drop kick by Takeshita, and he knocks Cage's head off with a lariat. Great sell by the big guy. Takeshita lands a German suplex with Bridge and a Liger bomb. Cage goes for the drill claw. It's avoided. Takeshita then lands a brain buster and another brain buster. A TKO by Brian Cage. Then Takeshita lands an avalanche brain buster and a jumping knee strike for the win. I thought this was a very good, very strong pro wrestling match. Is it off the walls, insane match of the year? No. It was great, good, solid stuff. Great work by Brian Cage, working to put the other... He was told by the boss, you got to put my guy over. You can get your shit in, but you got to put my guy over. And that's what he did. This is what, you know, I know a lot of people have very mixed feelings about Brian Cage, but as a professional wrestler goes, everything he did here was fantastic. And they were both able to keep up with each other. A similar sized big man like Brian Cage having a match with Takeshita would have been something completely different. I thought they were able to play off of both each other's strengths and it looked great. Takeshita comes off looking very strong. It's good. Jericho Appreciation Society is backstage with Renee Paquette. They say they don't like being called cheaters by Ricky Starks. And if Ricky wants another match, they're going to have to go through the Garcia Guevara gauntlet. What the hell is that, Warren? Well, allow me to explain via Daniel Garcia, who took the time to break it down for us. This gauntlet means that Starks will have to beat Angelo Parker, then beat Matt Menard, then beat Daniel Garcia or Sammy Guevara. They'll decide the night of who the guy's going to be. And then if they manage to do all of that, then and only then will Ricky Starks get a shot at Chris Jericho. This is from what I'm gathering, this is going to be a one-night thing. Like, it's literally going to be a gauntlet match. Where it's going to be one guy after another, right? I think it's a little strange to be running this angle while your main event angle right now is kind of that. It's pretty much that. Like, Bryan Danielson right now has to wrestle every week to prove that he's the number one contender, right? So that he can get a match at Revolution against MJF. It's a little strange, a wee bit bizarre that we're doing like something very similar. It's not going to be stretched out over weeks, but this idea of going through guys to get to one guy, it's already being done. Why are we getting a double dose of this? And, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, I understand that Jericho, his character, he perceives himself as a prize, right? He's a sports entertainer. He's a big star, so on and so forth. Like, so he's a prize. So if you want to wrestle, you know, you want to wrestle the prize, you have to work for it. These are all things I understand. I just think that in the context, it's a little weird. But this is what everyone is failing to latch on to. They prefer to latch on to this as opposed to latch on to the idea that they are continuing to push Ricky Starks as a big fucking deal. They would not be doing this if they didn't think Ricky Starks was a big deal. And they wouldn't be putting him in a feud with Chris Jericho if he wasn't a big fucking deal. And this is what I think everyone is still failing to latch on to, is that Ricky Starks is in a feud with Chris Jericho. And Ricky Starks is looking like $1 million through it.
Oh, the black hole of the Jericho Appreciation.
There's no black hole. Not now anyway. They want to build up to get a match at Revolution. This is clearly what's going to happen, right? Ricky Starks and Chris Jericho at Revolution. Because otherwise, what's the thing? Cutting promos on each other week after week? That's fine. If you want that, there's another promotion that does that perfectly. There's another promotion, major North American promotion that does that. If you want to have a build to a pay-per-view, be two guys cutting promos on each other week after week. It exists. It's out there. I am okay with this in the measure that this continues to position Ricky Starks as a top guy. But I hope that this doesn't become too much of a thing where we have a bunch of heels having baby faces run through gauntlets at once, you know? You know, I know a lot of people are annoyed with MJF doing this again. I will still argue here, right in front of you. I will tell you to your face that this is perfect because this is MJF's MO and this is what he should be doing. He should be doing this instead of doing fake campaigns, you know, fake presidential campaigns to get a match with the world champion. Like, that actually stinks. That's not very good and weird and doesn't make sense. What he's doing here makes sense. And we're going to talk about this in a second anyway. Then we have the Elite that cut a promo from a gym. They're playing basketball. They call out Top Flight and they say, let's go. Bring AR Fox. Let's do it. Dynamite next week. Mwah. There you go. You got yourselves another extraordinary match set up next week on Dynamite. And then the firm arrives. Stokely Hathaway sets up a match against them and Ethan Page, Matt Hardy, and Isaiah Cassidy for Rampage. So again, they're doubling down on putting the big stars on Rampage. And clearly, Tony was serious this time around when he was saying, no, look, we're putting big names on Rampage moving forward. We need to boost these ratings. And it's been paying off. Rampage has been doing better, has it been? Mind-blowingly extraordinary ratings? No, but there has been an improvement. They haven't hit the lows that they've hit last fall. Imagine that. You put your big names on a show, it stops feeling like a B show. Imagine that. A bit of a weird segment, if we're being honest, with Cassidy moaning sexually in Kenny Omega's ear. I don't know what was going on there. Then Brian Danielson defeated Timothy Thatcher. Thatcher tries to work the shoulder of Brian Danielson early on. Danielson uses the leg. Corner kicks by Danielson, but Thatcher smacks him and continues abusing the shoulder, which, by the way, right, is the story of this whole match, but also of this entire angle that we have going with MJF, because it's not just a question of MJF throwing dudes at Danielson. It's a very specific thing. It's like, you have to soften this guy's arm. That's what he told Brian Cage 2 weeks ago for his match last week. I don't care if you beat him or not. I want you to work his shoulder. Why did he, being MJF, bring in Timothy Thatcher this week? For that exact reason. Because Thatcher is a guy who is renowned for limb work, joint manip. Commentary put this over wonderfully. So if anyone was wondering, why this guy? You just have to listen to commentary, right? Put up the volume. JR's not on, so it's the booth is wonderful. And so he continues to work the arm and the shoulder, and that's the thing. That's what MJF wants, because, and commentary put this over as well, MJF uses the Fujiwara armbar as a submission as well. So if Danielson is coming in, and he had all this kinesio tape on his shoulder already when he hit the ring, we're selling this injury, we're selling this as a thing. This is going to be a focal point of their match at Revolution. It's going to be the arm. It's going to be a thing. And this is the story we're telling. Now, I'm sorry, there's not like 7-minute promos at the start of every Dynamite to explain this and have people pull faces at each other. But this makes sense. This is storytelling in pro wrestling. This is how it should go. You're like, they're doing this. This is like, the strategy is clear. The story is clear. I don't know what to tell you. I don't need to have, you know, millions of minutes of promo time shoved down my throat to explain this to me. I get it. I understand. Storytelling for grown-ups. This is what this is. It's basic. It works. It's a simple formula, and it's working because the talent that are involved are fantastic, and they're understanding how to make this work. And this is the entire, this is what happens the entire match. The arm, the shoulder, arm trap backdrop by Thatcher, and he just pummels as he traps the arm. Danielson fights back with a missile dropkick, but he sells the shoulder when he lands after the missile dropkick. Later on, Danielson goes for the round kicks. Thatcher blocks one. Danielson rolls through a Fujiwara armbar attempt. He goes for the hammer and anvil elbows. There's a ref bump back there's a ref bump that happens, and then MJF arrives, and he's got the diamond ring, and he puts it on his finger, but he's blindsided out of nowhere by a guy in a hoodie, and it's Kanesuke Takeshita, who said that he had Danielson's back. So he's pushing him back. They fight back up the ramp. So even if there's a ref bump happening, MJF can't get his shit in. Great stuff. Thatcher finally lands in a Fujiwara armbar. Danielson fights out. Thatcher lands a belly-to-belly suplex. But the Busaiku knee puts him away. Look, this story's great. This story is spot on. Commentary reminded us, don't forget, MJF uses the Fujiwara armbar. This has been the whole story. And I mean, and here's the thing. And again, maybe this is because I do watch pro wrestling in Japan, where everyone or most people are in factions, right? But not all the factions come to ringside, and not all the time with, you know, it depends on the faction. So people, why isn't the BCC looking out for Danielson? Why is it Takeshita that this doesn't make sense? Well, listen here, listen. Backstage, MJF and Takeshita are still fucking brawling. And then what happens? You know, Pat Buck and his gang come in to break it up, and then Renee Paquette arrives to say that per Tony Khan, that's really funny, per Tony Khan, we're getting MJF versus Takeshita next week. So what is this story even doing? We're continuing to elevate Kanesuke Takeshita as a star on this TV show because he's hanging out with the top echelon of guys in this company. What is this doing? They're elevating this guy. Another star. It could be Yuta. It could be Yuta. But Yuta's already had his time in the spotlight. He's already an established guy. People know who he is. Let's push another guy. Let's get another guy up there in the form of Kanesuke Takeshita, who is already over, that people already dig. And now he's going to fight the top villain in the company. How do people then just go and stick to, well, I don't like this because it should be the BCC. And then these are going to be the same people who are going to turn around and say, well, there's no stars. They don't build stars. They just hang around, you know, WWE guys. And this is exactly what we're doing here. Jesus Christ. They're getting an eliminator match next week for MJF. And MJF, in the meantime, is like, what? What the fuck is this? I didn't approve this. And he's continuing his shtick, being the attraction. I only wrestle when I want to, so on and so forth. And Tony Khan's like, no, man, we're doing this next week because I smell money, right? He's being a promoter. Tony Khan is being a promoter. He's not this, you know, this, the, he's, this isn't a, an action from some beneficial, from some, you know, this higher power that looks out for all his interests. He's like, no, MJF, Takeshita, you guys are fighting. Let's do it, you know? That's fine. This is pro wrestling. Let's fucking go. We get a video package for Swerve Strickland versus Brian Pillman Jr. It's going to happen on Rampage this week. Swerve also talks, though, more importantly, about how Dusty Rhodes has gotten under his skin. Dustin, excuse me. I mean, you know, if you get some dust, you get Dusty Rhodes under your skin, that's a little weird, not to lie. And we also find out that Grandin Goetzmann's name, the mystery tattoo guy, the former baseball player, Grandin Goetzmann, his name is Trench. Trench. Okay. Then Roosh and the Ingobernables are backstage. MJF, they're being interviewed, but MJF interrupts, trying to speak Spanish, and delivers a briefcase full of money, and saying there's another one if Roosh can beat Bryan Danielson next week by any means necessary. Again, this is an efficient, compelling story that is going to play out wonderfully at Revolution. I don't know what anyone has an issue here with. So they accept the money. Roosh doesn't seem impressed, but he accepts the offer. And you see, no one likes MJF. See, Roosh is like, you're bringing me money, but I still think you're a punk. You know, like, no one really likes MJF because he's a son of a bitch, and that's cool. The heels don't necessarily want to work together. They're all like, eh. Get the AEW TBS title match. Jade Cargill defeated Red Velvet. She's 50-0. Red Velvet goes after her right before the bell, which is always something I like when there's emotional stakes. Hits a wrecking ball drop kick. Red Velvet goes for a Cazadora, but Jade Cargill blocks it and just overhead slams her. Just great stuff. Red Velvet flies off the apron when they're on the floor. Cargill catches her. Cargill then gorilla presses her, walks casually up the stairs, up onto the ring apron, and then just dumps Velvet in the ring. Great, great visual. Single leg drop kick and a lung blower by Velvet. Cargill hits the bitch-sickle kick. Kira Hogan runs in to take out Lila Gray. That distracts the ref. That allows Red Velvet to hit a move and get the visual three count on Jade Cargill, which I don't think we had seen before. I think this is the first time we actually see someone get in a three on her, right? But by the time the ref comes back, it's too late. She kicks out, she being Cargill, and she powers out of an armbar. Woman handles, literally. Like, just, she's just like Red Velvet, and she's just like doing whatever the hell she wants with her to get her back into a Jaden and Lanza. This is, Jade is unquestionably an attraction. This is what she does. And every time her strength is put on display, it is cash money. Every time you see this woman do these fantastic feats of strength, like pressing someone and walking up the steps to dump her in the ring and just like tossing her around to get her into her move without dropping it. I get it. Like, you know, Red Velvet is not, you know, she weighs like 90 pounds. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean? Like, she's very, very light. Jade could probably press 9 of me, you know? So it's like, it's not that big, you know, I'm sure she's okay. She's okay. It doesn't require all that much effort, but the visual of it is still outstanding. And this is still Jade's big advantage, doing these types of moves. Didn't see nothing new from Cargill here, but we didn't need to. That wasn't the point. That's fine. And then this leads into the AEW TNT title No Holds Barred match, where Samoa Joe has once again become the undisputed king of television by defeating Darby Allin in a fucking wild, absolutely wild, no holds barred match, no DQ match, and in a result that I was not expecting at all. Darby Allin comes to the ring with a hoodie with tags, and I would probably tell you all, I think I'm going to say this safely, the tax hoodie was probably the least interesting thing of this match. You come out and go, oh, but we didn't need it. Like, it was just like for the, oh, we see he's serious, so on and so forth. Maybe there's some, you know, oh, Darby's ready to do anything. But it turns out in this match that the hoodie with the tax is the least interesting thing that occurred. Because Samoa Joe, he's like, he rips it off of him at some point, just tosses it out, slaps him down, and then he goes outside, Joe does, to get a table. But as he's carrying the table, Darby Allin suicide dives right onto the table, upright onto Joe. Fucking great, spectacular stuff. We're like a couple of minutes in here. Just a wild bump. And there's another wild bump with Darby Allin over the steps into the audience. They're both busted open at this point. Joe clearly went hard way because he got stitches. Joe carries Darby Allin up into the audience, up into the high up in the rafters, and he back body drops Darby Allin on the concrete steps. What the fuck? Get back into the ring. Joe jabs him. A couple of jabs. Beats him down. Darby Allin slaps. Joe takes a run at him, but Joe's in the corner. You know what that means. Uranagi. Samoa Joe goes back outside and sets another table up against the rail at an angle. And he gets back into the ring and he just tosses Darby Allin to the floor. He just like Taz said on commentary, like when you take off a t-shirt and you just take it off and you fling it. This was a mauling is what this was. Like they sat down before the match and said, what are we going to do? And Darby's like, man, do whatever you want. Just throw me around. And you sure? Yeah. This was outstanding. Get a brain buster back in the ring. Samoa Joe goes to get some chairs. And he sets up some chairs, upright chairs, and he just drops Darby Allin back first onto the upright chairs. I don't know, like, this is nuts. Just nuts. And Joe is taking so much pleasure in doing this. Darby Allin, he tries to do it again, him being Samoa Joe, tries to drop him on chairs again. But Darby Allin uses some powder. The visual was a little lost. I don't think camera picked it up correctly. But he uses some powder to get an advantage, flipping stunner on Joe. He puts the tack hoodie back on. And again, you know, it doesn't quite work out. He does a thumbtack-covered coffin drop, basically. But Samoa Joe kicks out of it. So you could argue, you know, oh, well, he didn't have, you know, the full tacks on, you know, he wasn't wearing the hoodie properly. Anyway, bit of a wardrobe malfunction here. Darby Allin then goes off and he starts cutting the canvas ropes. He starts breaking, taking the ring apart, and he's taking off the canvas ropes. And I think there were a little more things holding the ring together than he expected. Thank God he had a really fucking good knife to do it. Like his thank God for that. But it took a little while. But finally, he takes the mats off. He exposes the pine, right, of the ring. Samoa Joe's on the floor. Darby Allin goes for a dive. And of course, what does Samoa Joe do? He does. He nopes it. And Darby Allin goes through that table he set up. Powerbomb on the tag jacket by Samoa Joe. Darby Allin fights back with some chair shots, but it all comes to a viciously crashing end with an avalanche muscle buster. Samoa Joe on the pine. Samoa Joe wins the title in a batshit insane match. What a fucking great match. I might actually add this as an early contender to my match of the year. It will probably be outdone down the road. The year is still young. This was nuts, but I have to be able to remember this match when we start compiling our lists at the end of the year. This was nuts. And I could watch these guys wrestle each other every fucking week. The series of three that they put on together, every match has been great, has been fun to great. What a great little series of matches that they went through. Just excellent stuff. We're not done after the match. Wardlow is here. He shows up, runs in after Joe. Joe takes a powder, hits the bricks. But then there's security that comes in. Wardlow starts geeking them out, punches them. And the show ends with Wardlow grabbing one of the dudes and powerbombing him outside of the ring onto the other dudes. As commentary is saying, powerbomb to the floor! And it goes to black just on all this chaos. It ends in the most perfect Nitro way where you have commentary going, this is the end. We'll see you next week. Oh my God, he just powerbombed him to the floor. Fade to black. on the chaos. Like, everything, there's still shit going on. I would have loved Tony Schiavone to say, "We'll keep the cameras rolling, folks." You know, like he used to do back in the day. As in to say, "We'll show you the footage that you missed next week," or whatever, that you never really ended up seeing. But still, you know, cameras are still rolling, folks. I wish they'd do that just once in these Nitro finishes. Because this was great. All of this was great. You end the show with chaos, with Wardlow getting a big return. You know, this Wardlow fella that everyone has been telling me, oh no, he's, no one likes him anymore, he's not over anymore, comes out to a monster reaction from the crowd. What are you talking about? Has he been cooled off? Yes. But is he any less over with the audience? I heard a reaction. I heard a big pop for the guy. People still love Wardlow. We're getting Wardlow and Joe again. All right, I'm for it. No triple threats, no nonsense, no extra bodies in this. Let's just go Samoa Joe Wardlow. Let's do a one-on-one thing. Let him go 10 minutes tops. Just let them beat the shit out of each other for 10 minutes. It doesn't even need to be a 20-minute thing. It doesn't even need to be a 15-minute thing. I think you get maximum advantage out of these two tough guys, these two big dudes just wailing on each other athletically for 10 minutes in a sprint, than trying to drag this out. That's what I want out of Wardlow, Samoa Joe. That's what I want. No triple threats, no fatal four ways. That's just 10 minutes tops. These two guys, roll it. Again, another great Dynamite. Maybe a little bit of a lull last week. I thought last week, you know, the energy wasn't there. This week, it was all out. Everything was hanging out. I love this show. I love this wrestling show. We had six wrestling matches on this show. One, which we can argue was a squash, that's fine. Let's say five full wrestling matches on this show, on a two-hour thing. And they were all entertaining. Some of them were actually great. Opened up with a fantastic match and ended up finishing the show with an even better one, if you can believe it. Outstanding stuff. That's how we're going to wrap up this week's Dynamite review. If you haven't already, consider liking the video. Subscription to the Mr. Warren Hayes Show channel on YouTube is also super great, just as is any love that you can show on your favorite podcast app. 5-star reviews, 5-star ratings, whatever you can do, that stuff helps out a great deal. I will be back on Tuesday for the Mr. Warren Hayes Show proper. Otherwise, I will be back right here next Thursday for another AEW Dynamite review. In the meantime, I hope you have a great rest of your week. Thank you for listening, most importantly, and I will see you next time.